In this episode, I talked to Dr. Sharon Lewin, a leading HIV researcher and the director of the Peter Daugherty Institute for Infection and Immunity in Melbourne, Australia. She's also the acting president of the International AIDS Society. I couldn't have been luckier to learn about HIV from someone with so much knowledge in the field. Professor Lewin tells me about the science of the virus, the history behind it, and even about social issues. I learn what curing HIV means and where treatment stands today. We even talk about the future of HIV care and its intersection with other industries. And Sharon tells us how innovation can drive change at a global level. It's hard to pick a favorite part here. The conversation is full of gems. So sit back and enjoy the episode. You are now listening to the Gustavo Franco podcast, where we challenge the norms and uncover the truths of our healthcare system. I'm your host, Gustavo Franco. Hey, Professor Lewin, great to have you here. Very excited for this conversation today. I think that to give a background for the entire conversation that we're going to have, we should start with the background of the HIV virus and how that actually progressed into AIDS. So if you could talk a little bit about the biology of the virus, how would you best describe it for a person that might not be like a biology major?
Sure. So the HIV is the virus and AIDS is the disease caused by the virus. And the HIV virus enters the body through blood or bodily fluids, so transmitted by sexual contact or sharing of needles or blood transfusion, and it targets an immune cell. So HIV can get inside one of the immune cells in your blood and then makes copies of itself and then goes on to infect more immune cells. And this process proceeds very, very quickly. So that actually in someone that's not treated for HIV, every day there's billions of copies of virus being made. And amazingly enough, our bodies can cope with that because we make some immune response to it. And this can go on for decades actually, and the person doesn't even know they're infected. But over time, what the virus is doing is slowly chipping away at the immune system. And once the immune system becomes critically low, the person becomes sick with AIDS. And that whole process can actually take over 10 years. However, if you do a test, you can find the virus in the blood within days of someone being infected.
Interesting. And then say for the bio geeks out there, right? You mentioned the immune cells. Are those the CD4 helper T cells usually?
That's right. Yeah. So our immune system consists of different drains or flavors or different cell types. There's one cell type called T cells. And there's lots of different ways we define T cells depending on what proteins they express on the cell surface. We can tag them. And we now with modern day immunology, we know lots and lots about all different types of T cells. But HIV targets CD4 positive T cells. And the reason why it does that is because it needs CD4 to enter a cell. The lock and key for HIV entry requires the virus and its spike protein, or what we call the envelope protein, and the target, which is CD4.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that there's usually like a 10-year progression of the virus in the body, right? I've heard that they're usually called phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3. What are like the distinct characteristics of those phases?
Well, we have changed the terminology actually over years, because nowadays we never let anyone go through those phases. As soon as you're diagnosed, we treat you straight away. But we didn't used to do that. And of course, prior to the 90s, we didn't have treatments. But if you had someone with HIV where treatment was not started, the first phase is usually what we call primary infection. The person's exposed to the virus. There's lots and lots of virus replicating. About 50% of people develop a glandular fever-like illness, but 50% are completely asymptomatic. And if you measure the virus in the blood over that time, there's millions of copies of virus per milliliter of blood. But your own immune system kicks in and controls the virus never eliminates it, but controls it, and it brings it down to a steady level. And then after that primary infection phase, there's a chronic phase. We used to call it the clinically latent phase, but that's a bit misleading. But essentially chronic meaning that you have the virus, it's replicating, but you're not unwell. And then the final phase is when you start losing CD4 T cells, or the CD4 T cells drop to a critical level, usually less than 350 or less than 200. Normal levels are greater than 500. And once your CD4 T cells drop to a critical level, that is what we call AIDS. And also your body's open to getting unusual infections and unusual malignancies, or what we call opportunistic infections or AIDS-related malignancies. And occasionally, and even in Australia, about 20% of people are actually diagnosed in that late phase, meaning they've had HIV for 10 years or more, they've never been tested, and they turn up to their doctor with an unusual infection that makes the doctor think, oh, could this be HIV? In many countries, our overall goal of HIV programs is to stop that happening, because you don't want to be picking up someone who's had HIV for 10 years. It's much better to get them very early on.
Right. So I understand that this is the progression in a person that's not treated for the virus, right? So can you actually completely prevent the person from getting AIDS in the first place, so that they only have the HIV virus in their body, but they don't develop the N condition that you mentioned?
Absolutely, yes. And antiviral therapy does exactly that. We have very few cases now of AIDS in Australia, because we know close to 95% of people are on treatment and have controlled virus. So what happens when you go on treatment, and this is what we call antiretroviral therapy, which is a combination of antiviral drugs, at least two, sometimes three drugs, very effective. And now even injections, so not all tablets. We can give injections once every 2 months. And within about 3 to 4 weeks of going on to modern day antiretrovirals, you can no longer measure blood in, you can no longer measure virus in the blood. The virus is still in the body, and if you use sophisticated research tests, you can find it. It never goes away. But with the routine clinical tests, you can't find virus in the body. You're still antibody positive. So if you went and had an HIV test, you'd be antibody positive. And the virus is put under control, and your immune system, if it was damaged before, will slowly recover. And if this is done at the right time, a person lives a normal, healthy life, actually has a normal life expectancy. And more amazingly enough, the person cannot transmit HIV sexually while they're on treatment.
Oh, that's really interesting. That's really interesting. I do want to talk more about the treatment, but first, just going back to the background, I think it's important for especially people in my generation to really understand how this was a big pandemic in the 80s, right? We just had COVID, and that was massive. I know we're going to remember that, like it's in the back of our minds for many years now. But I talked to my parents, and it's the same situation for HIV, right? When they had the outbreak, I mean, they literally remember that as if it were yesterday. It was super significant in their lives. But in my generation, we only hear about that, and it's hard to really grasp the significance and the impact that it had in the medical community and also in society. So to give some background on that initial outbreak, what were the presentations of people with untreated AIDS and the HIV virus, right? How did they present, and what were usually their health outcomes?
So the first presentations of people with AIDS were in 1981. At the time, we didn't know the cause of AIDS. What was seen was young, largely gay men who appeared in hospitals in New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles with unusual infections or unusual malignancies. The very earliest ones was an unusual form of pneumonia called PCP, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, a pneumonia that you never see in someone who's otherwise healthy. You can see it in people who have very, very suppressed immune systems, say, following an organ transplantation. So the first cases were with pneumocystis pneumonia and a rare type of skin cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma. again, very, very rare to see that in a otherwise immunocompetent person, and even rare to see it in a Western country. It's quite common in parts of Africa, but not in high-income countries. So in the 1981, doctors started seeing gay men with these unusual infections and unusual cancers. And then it became apparent that there were also infections happening in parts of the world such as Haiti. And then there were infections that appeared in people that received blood transfusions, such as hemophiliacs who were receiving repeated infusions from pool donors. And it actually took some time to work out how it was being transmitted. Because at the beginning, when you see a new infectious disease and you try and track how it is traveling through a community, you use epidemiology. You try and see, does case A link to case B? And because HIV has such a long period before you become sick, and no one knew that these cases of AIDS were being caused by HIV, and there was no test for HIV, that didn't come along till 1985, so 4 years later. So can you imagine that? Like, just think how quickly things moved with COVID. It took another 2 years until 1983 to work out that HIV was the cause of AIDS, and another 2 years after that to develop a test. So you were just basing your epidemiological investigations on a clinical presentation and trying to work out where people were connected or not. So very quickly on, I was a young medical student at that time, so I only know this from the history books, but very quickly people realised that they were seeing more of these cases in gay men than anyone else. But there were cases of people from Haiti or hemophiliacs. And so then a whole lot of theories started emerging. You know, was this because of amyl nitrate that gay men were taking? Was it because of some unusual sexual practice or a drug? Or, you know, and we saw this a little bit in the beginnings of COVID, whenever there is a new infectious disease, there is an element of, there's lots of unknowns, and unknowns can lead to conspiracy theories, and conspiracy theories can also lead to hysteria. So there was a lot of that happening because there wasn't the evidence to say, no, you can sit next to someone with HIV and you're completely safe. Because at the beginning, people were thinking, God, you know, I don't want to get this disease. So at the very earliest days, this is how it was presenting. And it took some time to, first of all, grow the virus and identify it was a retrovirus, and then to actually link that the viral infection was connected to these disease manifestations. And then, as I said earlier, it took another 2 years to have the test. Now, once you have the test, it became much easier to really understand how the epidemiology of HIV, because you had a way of identifying people who were carrying the virus but weren't sick. And it's a really good parallel to COVID, because we didn't know about asymptomatic transmission with COVID at the beginning. So we were kind of getting certain things wrong on how to manage the public health response to COVID. But once we knew that there was asymptomatic transmission, it all changed.
Mm-hmm. So you did a wonderful job there, really describing how the medical community responded to the virus at the beginning. But you did mention a couple of times how it was kind of considered the gay disease, right? And I think that understanding how society responded to that connotation is really important. So could you describe a little bit how society actually responded to that and how it kind of stirred things up in society?
Yeah, that's a very big part of the HIV story, no doubt about that. And the early 80s were a very different time for gay men, or men who have sex with men, because it was all very underground. There was a huge amount of stigma. Gay rights movement was really just coalescing and becoming visible in the late 70s, and not globally. It was in pockets like San Francisco, for example, in the late 70s. But most gay, there was a huge amount of stigma associated being with gay. Most gay interactions were underground and a bit hidden. And so therefore you had a new infectious disease with quite very significant and dramatic outcomes, meaning death. We're not talking COVID, we're talking about young men in the prime of their lives developing these weird and awful illnesses that no one had treatments for and dying. And a part of a community that the rest of the world didn't understand terribly much. And if they did, there was an enormous amount of stigma and poor understanding, very different to the world now that you and your friends live in. Very, very different. So in contrast to COVID, people didn't really want to talk about this and they didn't really understand it. And then there were, of course, other affected communities such as sex workers. Many countries, sex work was and still is illegal. People who inject drugs. All of these different communities were not communities that were empowered, visible within power structures of countries that can find solutions to major pandemics, like, as again, in contrast to COVID, where COVID was affecting big business. And so the story, I think, is a very interesting one in Australia and a very different one to many other countries. And that was that in the very early 80s, in response to HIV was very progressive, and very quickly our health minister realised I can only deal with all of this by working with these communities. So it was heavily stigmatised. It was affected communities that weren't mobilised or powerful, and different countries handled it in different ways. And, you know, I may sound like I'm talking about distant history here, but there are many countries in the world right now that live in that sort of environment. You know, Uganda is one of those that has, you know, homosexuality is illegal. All of this activity happens underground. In the Central Asia and Russia, people who inject drugs get very little support, very heavily stigmatized. So these same major social issues that have impacted the progress against HIV are alive and well in many other parts of the world, just not in our world.
Yeah. So last week I watched the movie Philadelphia. I do want to hear your thoughts on the movie, but I thought for myself, at least, to really paint a good portrayal of the social impact that the virus had, right? And a lot of what you just talked about was kind of showed, they were able to show that in the movie, whereas I hadn't heard it before, but really watching the movie gave me a better picture of what was actually happening. I'm sure there are many things that they might not portray in the best way possible, but what are your thoughts on the movie?
I haven't seen the movie for a while, but I think it does give you a good insight into certainly the stigma around it and the lack of knowledge people had about HIV and the incredible discrimination that people with HIV suffered and still do suffer from. But there's a few, it's a good movie to see. And there's another one called And the Band Played On, and that really tells you about the very early days of HIV, particularly in the US, and how the discovery of HIV causing AIDS and then the test to identify HIV all unfolded and all the various players around the world in that story.
That's cool. I'll give that one a watch too. So now let's go back to treating HIV, right? What does finding a cure for HIV really mean here?
So HIV is a part of a family of viruses that are called retroviruses. And a retrovirus has the unique property of being able to integrate into our own DNA. So most viruses don't do that. COVID, you get it's an RNA virus. HIV is an RNA virus. But with COVID, you get infected and your body clears it and it goes away. Many, many viruses are like that. But HIV gets integrated very quickly into your own DNA. So once a cell is infected, it's infected for life, even if you go on treatment. The treatment does is it stops the virus going on to infect new cells. So it basically freezes everything and stops ongoing rounds of viral infection. But you are stuck with infected cells for the lifespan of those cells. And HIV is a very smart virus. It gets into, I said earlier that there's all different flavors and types of T cells, even all different flavors and types of CD4 positive T cells. And some of those cells are very long-lived because they form your immunological memory. And memory in your immune system needs to, you know, see you out for your entire life. And so HIV gets into these long-lived memory cells and essentially is there forever. Now, if you it doesn't cause you any problems, to be honest, when you're on treatment, because these infected cells are rare, about one in a million, carry virus that's capable of replicating. However, once you stop treatment, that virus is still there, and all you need is for that cell to be activated because it's doing its job as a memory T cell, and the virus pops out and the whole thing starts again. And generally, on average, when someone stops antiviral treatment, it takes about 2 to 3 weeks and the virus pops up again and the whole thing gets going. Pretty much in everyone. We've got a few rare cases of people that can control the virus after stopping treatment, but it's very unusual. Most people would come straight back up. And that's when the virus is in hiding, buried inside someone's DNA, not replicating, we call that latent infection. I should say many viruses have a latent form. It's a very cool way for viruses to evade the immune system and persist, because ultimately all viruses want to do is survive. So they find all these, you know, tricky ways to survive and persist. And so latency is a common route for survival for many viruses, but HIV does this via burrowing inside someone's DNA and staying silent until the person stops treatment. So I'm a clinician and I did my specialist training in infectious diseases in the early 90s. So it was just at the beginning of, the treatments for HIV became available in the mid 90s. So I saw a little bit of what the world was like without treatment. And I saw how the world dramatically changed in 95, 96 with the advance of treatment. And at the very beginning, we thought treatment might have cured people because you saw this rapid decline of virus in the blood. But actually, the virus was lurking all the time inside these long-lived T cells. But the thought that someone could cure HIV was thought to be impossible, as something to think about and work on, but probably impossible, until 2010, when the first report of a man was made who was cured of HIV. And that person's name is Timothy Brown. And he was an American man living in Berlin who had HIV but then developed leukemia, and he received a bone marrow transplant from a donor who was naturally resistant to HIV. I mentioned earlier HIV uses CD4 to get inside a cell, but it actually has a second receptor called CCR5, and about 5% of Caucasians lack that receptor of CCR5. So Timothy Brown received a bone marrow transplant from a donor who was CCR5 negative, contained the mutation that person's cells didn't express CCR5. So Timothy got a whole new bone marrow following his transplant, which were all cells that were CCR5 negative. And when they stopped his antiviral treatment, the virus didn't rebound. And there's since been 5 further cases described like this. So 6 people that are completely cured of HIV. But what the consequence of the report from Timothy Brown in the New England Journal in 2010 was that people thought, well, this is possible. You know, maybe this is a really unusual freak of nature, but this is really possible. So a lot of work has then been galvanized on seeing, can we reduce this pool of latently infected cells, can we eliminate them? Can we mimic CCR5 negativity through gene therapy? Can we boost the immune response to control HIV? There was a lot of work going on HIV latency before Timothy's story. In fact, I was in New York in the late 90s doing my postdoctoral fellowship, and that's what I was working on. I was working on HIV latency back in 97. To 99. And so there were a lot of people working on it, but most people thought a cure wasn't possible. But now treatments got better and better. At the time, it was many tablets a day. Now it's 1 tablet a day. It's one injection every 2 months. 70% of the world's population are on antiviral therapy. Antiviral therapy has become cheap in low and middle income countries. It costs about $100 a year to keep people on treatment. In Australia, it's about $25,000 a year, but in low and middle income countries, it's cheap. But it really does cost about $30 billion a year to treat everyone who needs treatment for HIV. So whether that's a sustainable amount of investment is unclear, but there's a reason why we do need a cure, because long-term treatment forever for everyone may not be possible.
And I guess it would be a lot better if people didn't have to take the pills every single day, right?
Absolutely. If you speak to someone with HIV, and we've done a lot of work on that, speaking, research on people who live in high income countries like Australia, where public health free healthcare, great public health system, the best drugs in the world that anyone can access. But most people, even in Australia, most people living with HIV would love to not have that long-term infection. And when you look globally, the need is even higher.
Mm-hmm. So in recent research in these past years, are there any clues as to how we can actually destroy these latent HIV cells?
Yeah. There's huge amounts of really cool stuff happening. We understand a lot about the virus now, largely through single cell technology. So there are ways now that you can literally sift through individual cells, find one that's infected, and then profile features of that cell. Because essentially, it's a needle in a haystack, because I mentioned earlier, one in a million cells are infected and there's nothing visible on the surface to say, hi, the virus is sitting here. But we have, with some advances in these single cell technologies, we're getting a really good insight into the virus. And we've learned a few things. We've learned that where the virus is integrated within the genome is actually important. It can go into these very silent parts of the genome and maybe even not cause much or cause no trouble, or it can go to an active part of the genome. We know that all latently infected cells are all very different. They're not all completely silent. They have low levels of transcription. And we know that they're probably primed to survive. They sit in cells that over time have adapted for survival. And so there's many things being tried. And some of the ways that we're getting rid of those cells is with gene therapy. So you can use gene editing or gene scissors to actually target the HIV virus itself. So you, instead of going in with gene scissors and chopping out a host gene, you go in and chop out the HIV virus. That's worked in monkeys, and there's a clinical trial now of gene therapy for HIV.
So in that case, would you find these cells that have the viral DNA integrated in their own genome, and then you would go in there and cut the viral DNA out and then put the genome back together?
Exactly. So that's happening right now in clinical trials in the US, but was done in monkeys. You can do things like permanently silence the virus. So you could, because the virus is controlled like your own genes. So we know a lot about how to turn genes on and turn genes off in basic molecular studies or in cancer studies. And so you can literally turn on the HIV virus or turn it off. And some people are trying to turn it off so that it's permanently silenced. Some people are trying to turn it on. And that's a lot of the work that we've done is around trying to turn the virus on. And the reason why we want to turn the virus on is there's very few cells that are infected, but they're not revealing that they're infected because they're silenced. They're not showing viral proteins on the surface. So if you could turn the virus on, the cell would now become visible to the immune system and cleared. And then another way to try and reduce the pool of infected cells is to get rid of these survival factors. So if these cells have different lifespans based on what proteins they express, survival proteins or death proteins. And so cancer happens because cancer cells express to very high levels these survival proteins that allow the cancer to proliferate and take over. But HIV itself, the latent infected, those cells can express survival proteins. So we've been using drugs that block these survival proteins. And on the flip side, a lot of people are trying to, rather than focus on getting the reservoir or the pool of cells smaller, they're focusing on enhancing the immune control of any virus that pops out. I think you probably have to do both, make the reservoir small and increase immunity. And there's different ways people are testing how to boost immunity.
So you mentioned the clinical trials in the US. Are they using any of the specific types that you just mentioned now?
Oh, yeah. There's hundreds of clinical trials happening in cure in the US, in Australia, in Europe, in South Africa, Thailand, all around the world. So, yes, we're using a range of immunotherapy, using tools to boost the immune system, using different gene therapies. You can use gene therapy to actually boost the immune system as well, using approaches I mentioned earlier, latency reversal, activating the virus, all sorts of things alone and in combination.
Very exciting. very exciting. So with all of that in mind, where do you see HIV treatment in, say, 10 years?
Well, I think treatment's going to get easier and easier and even better. But amazingly enough, most people, including me, thought one tablet a day was pretty good. But now you can get injections every 2 months. That's not suitable for everyone. Some people prefer just taking a tablet a day and seeing their doctor every 6 months. But the latest data says you could even have an injection every 6 months. And maybe one day we'll have an implant of antivirals so that you get your implant, you change it every couple of years. So that may be the future of treatment. The real challenge is implementing it. So in a country like Australia, where you have free healthcare and a very highly subsidised system and a very empowered community that run a whole lot of great ways to engage their people at risk of or infected with HIV, you can get up to pretty high levels of treatment. But in other countries like Pakistan or Russia or even parts of Africa, many parts of Africa have done very well, treatment uptake, even though we have these treatments that work, people still aren't taking them because they don't know they're infected, because they can't pay for the drugs, because they think that natural medicine is going to help them, not all sorts of reasons, socio-political reasons why. So I think over the next 10 years, we'll get better at delivering drugs globally. I hope we do.
Do you think we'll be able to find a cure by then?
Oh, I know a cure. I think a cure, it's very hard to say when we'll find a cure. The science is really difficult. We haven't had anything yet that's been a home run or far from it in the clinic. We've had some trials that suggest a subset of participants can control virus after the intervention. We've had cases of cure that I mentioned earlier. We've had cases of cured monkeys where people have tried a mix of different approaches in a monkey model and been able to show you could cure a monkey. But I think a large scale, a cure that's widely available, scalable, highly effective, single shot, never had to worry about HIV, I think we're a long way off that. But we might have something in 10 years where a certain subset of people can safely stop their antiviral therapy.
Cool. And I like that you brought up earlier the issue of actually being able to implement all of these changes that we're likely going to see in these coming years, right? And a lot of that won't come directly from, say, the research community. And a lot of people can still make an impact in HIV treatment being outside of the research community, right? So what are some ways that people can get involved in helping with HIV if they don't want to do specifically research?
Well, I think there is a lot of need for community and peer support. So some people who are diagnosed with HIV have a whole range of misconceptions about what it means. I think the most important thing that we need to do is make sure people are tested, make sure they know about treatment and what it means. Because if you don't get tested, then you can't have access to the treatments that are going to make a very big difference. I think there's a whole lot that can be done around stigma and discrimination. And there's a whole lot that can be done around government advocacy to make sure that people realise this isn't a problem that needs ongoing investment. One thing that people often say to me is, well, HIV is not a big deal anymore. Just take a tablet a day and it's not a problem, just like high blood pressure, which is kind of true. But the difference is that if you stop your high blood pressure tablets, no one else, it's not a problem for anyone else, just you. If you stop your HIV tablets, it is a big problem because not only will you ultimately get sick, but you have the risk of passing it on to other people. So it is still a big public health problem. And so governments can't afford to think it's going to just get solved on its own. And in many countries, there's major societal and legal barriers for people to access treatment. In countries where injecting drugs is illegal, where homosexuality is illegal, where sex work is illegal, in places like those, communities miss out on the public health messaging, can't access healthcare like many other people can. So there's a million and one things that need to be addressed beyond just new technologies.
Yeah. One interesting thing that I think people are excited about is the rise in like bioengineering, say computer science and AI in medicine. In what ways do you see that being implemented in this situation?
Well, I think it will be very relevant in cure. So we may at the moment, we just use the same drugs for everyone, and it works pretty well. You know, there's very few side effects for people once they go on drugs. But for cure interventions, we may need more precision medicine approach, identifying people that are most likely to respond to your intervention. So you're not going to be giving everyone this cure therapy. You identify people that are most at risk of it. We haven't talked at all about prevention, but there are some very incredible and very effective prevention tools for HIV as well. And they include, we don't have a vaccine for HIV, but we do have something called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, or the ability for people to take an antiviral drug, usually two drugs, can be an injectable drug as well, an antiviral that prevents you getting infection. So large-scale rollout for PrEP is a big challenge that hopefully we can do better in the future. And the other big change, I think, is around how we test. So, you know, at the very beginning, HIV testing was a big deal. You had to get consent from someone. They came in, they had their blood test. They'd come back 3 days later. And now we've got a whole suite of home-based testing tools. So I think that we've got to increase testing to really have a big impact on the pandemic.
So you mentioned that there's a drug that we can take that prevents you from getting the HIV virus. So who would really be the audience for that drug, right? Should everyone be taking this?
Definitely not. Not everyone, because the drug costs money and is only really needed in people at high risk of infection. And so for people that are in a high risk group who have multiple exposures to the virus, such as gay men who have multiple partners, people who inject drugs, partners of people who are infected in some cases. And you can either take the drug every day and it reduces your chance of getting HIV by over 95%, or you can take what's called event-driven PrEP, so before sex and after sex, and it also reduces the chance by over 95% of getting HIV. And now there's injectable PrEP. So there's big campaigns for people who are at risk of HIV to know about PrEP, work out whether their risk profile justifies taking it, and then to find a way to access it. And in a country like Australia, it's relatively easy. It's probably harder in rural communities within Australia, but in many, many countries, it's not widely available or subsidised.
And then going back to the idea of like computer science and AI, do you think that those can be integrated to better classify these groups that are highly at risk of infection? Is that where you see it?
Yeah, potentially. There's ways to maybe better understand transmission networks and understand how viruses move. This area is a little bit complex because there's social implications of being diagnosed, of transmitting. So there's a whole lot of ethical, community-based issues that would need to be explored when you start talking about AI and et cetera with HIV tracing. But yes, you could. So one thing that many countries are doing is that they sequence the virus at diagnosis. And because the HIV virus changes so easily, you can then assemble your viral sequence and see if there's a match to another viral sequence, and then with something we call molecular epidemiology. And then you can use that to enhance your ability for surveillance or to understand where the virus is being transmitted. Not to go out and punish the person that you think where the transmission occurred, but to have heightened input in prevention strategies in those communities. So that's another area where computer science is really relevant.
Cool. And then last thing here, you mentioned many times different countries and the global impact. So how do different countries respond to HIV right now? And are some countries significantly worse equipped to respond to the virus?
There's huge diversity in the response to HIV, and we do quantify that on a global level. There's an entity called UNAIDS, which is a division of the UN that was established, I think, in the early 2000s. And its goal is really to see, you know, the end of HIV as a public health threat. And so UNAIDS have determined some key targets for countries to reach, to demonstrate that they are on track to ending the HIV epidemic. And they have a target which is called 95-95-95 or 90-90-90, which is 90% of people aware of their status, 90% of people on antiviral therapy, and 90% having an undetectable viral load, meaning they're taking their treatment. And target for the world was to achieve 90-90-90 by 2020, I think, and 95-95-95 by 2025. And we are near that target in some countries. So Australia has hit that target, but there are countries that are nowhere near that. And there are countries where there are very few people on infections. So some of the areas that we really worry about are countries in North Africa and the Middle East, countries in Central Asia, particularly Russia, some countries in Asia Pacific, in Pakistan and the Philippines. But even within a country like the US, you can't just put a blanket number across the US. You look at black gay men in the South, and I don't know the data exactly, but they're nowhere near 90-90-90. If you look at white gay men in New York, they would be at that target. So there's enormous diversity in the uptake of treatment or the quality of public health messaging within countries, let alone between countries. Overall, the world is doing well. There is no doubt about that. The numbers of new HIV infections continues to decrease every year. The numbers of AIDS-related deaths continues to decrease every year. But when the targets that we have set, we have not reached yet.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. Well, I know that we're running short on time here. This was really insightful. I really look forward to see where this research goes in the future. And thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thanks very much, Gustavo.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Gustavo Franco Podcast. We hope our exploration of the world of healthcare has been insightful and thought-provoking for you. The opinions expressed here are ours and of our guests and should not be considered professional advice. This podcast is a collaborative learning experience for both the producers and listeners. While we strive to convey accurate and up-to-date information, we acknowledge that our research may have limitations. We encourage all of our listeners to supplement their knowledge by conducting their own research. If you enjoyed this episode and want to stay up to date on our future releases, make sure to subscribe or follow us on your preferred podcast platform and social media. We highly value your feedback, so please don't hesitate to reach out with your thoughts, questions, or suggestions for future topics. Together, we can foster a more educated America and contribute to a more effective healthcare future. Thank you for joining us on this healthcare exploration.